It's a hazy day today, and smoke from the recent California fires seems to have blocked out the sun, the central part of many philosophies based on astrotheology, a term that means the influence that celestial bodies have on religion. This got me thinking about the ancient Aryans. The Magi and ancient Babylonians, or Mesopotamians in general, were well known for their astronomy or astrotheology, meaning they studied the stars and planets, interpreting the meaning behind cosmic events. Although Magi is usually translated as wise men, in this context, it more accurately means astrologer, and it is in the pattern of the stars where the real meaning of the word Aryan stems from. While the year is divided into 12 months, there's a larger cycle of roughly 25,920 years, known as the precession of the equinoxes, in which there are 12 astrological ages of about 2,160 years each. Ancient civilizations often depicted cultural references to the ages. So, for example, the Age of Taurus spans approximately the period between 4400 and 2200 BC. It is the age defined by the sun being in the constellation of Taurus on the spring equinox. If you look at civilizations that flourished during this time, you'll notice a lot of bull symbolism. An example is the ancient Sumerian golden lyre of Ur, or bull's lyre, which is over 4,500 years old and is currently in the Baghdad Museum, with the head made of gold and blue eyes made of inlaid mother of pearl and lapis lazuli. The Age of Aries, or the ram, spans approximately the period between 2200 and 100 BC. Aries is the Greek god of war, one of the 12 Olympians, and the son of Zeus. Where the preceding Age of Taurus was a very matriarchal and feminine age, in which fertility cults and agricultural civilization flourished, the Aryan Age was one of incredible change with expansion and conquest. Venus is the planet ruling the sign and age of Taurus, and in ancient Babylon, Ishtar was the goddess of this great age, but the name changes depending on the civilization, but the venerated animal was the bull or cow. The official ending of the Age of Taurus occurred when the Israelites made their exodus out of Egypt and Moses symbolically destroyed the golden calf, ushering in the great age of Aries. Religions depict the start of this period with the solar deity symbolically slaying the bull, whether it be Mithra's statues killing the bull, ending the Age of Taurus, or the Minoan bull leaping, which later became the bullfighting, where the bull unfortunately is barbarically killed, or in mythologies such as the Epic of Gilgamesh, where he and Enkidu killed the bull of heaven. Of course, Hercules also fights the bull during his 12 labors, which symbolically represent the passage of the 12 zodiac signs, as in a prior age he fights lions, as does Gilgamesh and even the biblical Samson. In India, Agni, god of fire, rode on a ram. From his name, we derive the word ignite. We also derive Agnus Dei, which means the Lamb of God, who is slain in the next age, the Age of Pisces. Polarity is at the very heart of the symbol of Pisces, which is two fish swimming in opposite directions, yet fused together in union. The merging of opposites is the archetypal pattern of the age of Pisces. And so the ancient magician astronomers were not only aware of cycles that govern the yearly seasons, knowing which month to plant in and when it was time to harvest, they were also aware of what some call the great months or astrological ages, which are part of a much longer cycle, which, like the seasons, also impacts life on a macro and micro scale, regardless if one believes in it or not. So the ruling class used astrologer priests in guiding the way they governed, from the timing of great wars to events used for social engineering, to the schedule of magical rituals, which involved prolonged carnal activities, the consumption of psychoactive ingredients, trance-like states of consciousness, and the spoken word in a specific way, similar to chanting, which in today's terminology could be considered spell casting. There are about 445 living Indo-European languages, and all of them are descendants of a single prehistoric language, reconstructed as Proto-Indo-European, or Aryan, spoken sometime in the Neolithic era. Neolithic means Stone Age, and starts around 12,000 years ago, but I'm confident the Aryan tongue stretches back into the Pleistocene, or Ice Age. It's just harder to prove. Semitic and Indo-European languages are not classified as being in the same family, because neither group of language has an accepted identifiable common ancestor. But writing itself, which most scholars go by, is only about 5,000 years old, and what script a language is written in is not necessarily connected to the family of the language that the script is used to transcribe. For example, Hebrew script, which is nearly identical to Phoenician, has been used to write both ancient Hebrew, which is Semitic, as well as Yiddish, which is Indo-European, or High German to be more specific. The 22 characters that make up the Hebrew alphabet can be divided into 12 simples, mirroring the 12 months or ages, 7 doubles, like the days of the week, or the 5 visible planets plus the sun and the moon, as well as the elements fire, water, and air. But where did this alphabet come from? Old Hebrew, like the Phoenician alphabet, is a slight regional variant and an immediate continuation of the Proto-Canaanite script, which was used throughout Canaan in the late Bronze Age. Some archaeologists have claimed that its origins can be traced back to ancient Egyptian hieroglyphs over 3,800 years ago. Dr. Douglas Petrovich has spent several years piecing together the letters of the alphabet from inscriptions on Egyptian tablets. Here's a brief clip of him interviewed by Stephen DeNoon from the YouTube channel Israeli News Live.
Dr. Petrovich, welcome. And if you would, tell us a little bit about, you know, how you got started on this. How did you come about the discovery that the Hebrew, the ancient Hebrew alphabet, is actually derived from the Egyptian hieroglyphics?
Sure, it's great to be with you and with all of your viewers. I'd start by saying, first of all, I'm definitely not the first one who has connected the world's oldest script with Egyptian hieroglyphics. In fact, over 100 years ago, a British Egyptologist named Sir Alan Gardner wrote a very important work that even much of it stands until today, and he suggested very resoundingly that hieroglyphics are the basis of the world's oldest alphabet, which has always been, by the way, for 150 years of scholarship, been understood to be a Semitic language. So it's always been just a question of what is that Semitic language. And I'm actually also not the first to suggest that Hebrew is that correct Semitic language. That's the basis for this oldest alphabet. In 1923, there's a German scholar named Hubert Grimme who proposed this very thesis. And unfortunately, at his time, not enough was known about all of the individual letters of the alphabet. So he wasn't able to precisely identify all of the letters correctly. And if you're missing or you have wrong a few of the letters, that obviously you can understand is going to cause big problems for correctly deciphering the inscriptions, whatever Semitic language it is. And the other mistake that that Grima made was he didn't always accurately draw the inscriptions. And he didn't, at the same time, to his credit, didn't have the technology that we have today where we can do what I did, which is to take all of the important photographs of each of the inscriptions that I've translated, and I have projected them onto PowerPoint, and I'm able to study them at up to 400% magnification. And that allows me also to make a very precise computer-aided drawing that can be manipulated after you first try to draw it. So you can keep correcting it until you have it exactly right. As for how I was able to make these connections, it's really kind of by accident. I was just studying Syro-Palestinian archaeology and kind of stumbled into evidence for the Israelite occupation in Egypt before the Exodus, which translates to 1876 to 1446 BC. And that led me on a long archaeological trail in which I was able to identify just an amazing amount of evidence that really exists that's never really been documented or provided by scholars up until now. And probably part of that is because very few scholars are really careful in their study of the field of Egyptology and the field of biblical studies, and then the archaeology of the Levant, which is Syro-Palestine, Canaan, Israel. So in my case, I was able to not only find material cultural evidence such as ceramics and tools and weapons and architecture, but also inscriptional evidence with which I was able to identify several very important biblical figures. We have a picture both of the, or a photo of the inscription, and then a representation of my drawing of it as well. And Sinai 361, which reads top to bottom in columns from right to left, this inscription actually names Moses, in Hebrew named Moshe, which is the final two letters on the first vertical line on the fragment that's joined together to the main part of the stone featuring the inscription. And what it says is, how it reads is, our bound servitude had lingered. Moses then provoked astonishment. It is a year of astonishment because of the lady. And the lady refers to a foreign deity, also known as Baalat, the She Baal, so she is the consort of the storm god from the Levant, who is considered the chief of the gods, and she was connected to the worship that went on at the site of Sirbit Echadim. In fact, she had a temple there under her Egyptian name because the Egyptians connected her with Hathor, so there was a temple of Hathor at the site where a lot of these inscriptions were found. And the inscription is extremely important because it mentions activities that went on for the Israelites, for the Hebrew-writing people.
The consonants of the Hebrew language itself, as well as Phoenician, correlates to an ancient magical system where letters are assigned a numeric value, a crucial part of Kabbalah, and more specifically, gematria or numerology, which was practiced in all ancient empires from Assyria, Babylon, Greece, Egypt, and likely even earlier. This numeric value can also be applied to other languages, such as Arabic, Spanish, Greek, and English. These alphabets were not based on random sounds, but instead on mathematics, as the language of the gods appears to be linked to number and sacred geometry, which by extension can also be seen in the architecture of many of the ancient temples, as well as more modern cathedrals and mosques. That said, some researchers have also linked the Proto-Hebrew alphabet to the Germanic runes, as there was contact with ancient Phoenicians and Northern Europe, as not only was Europe itself named after Europa, a Phoenician princess, but the Norwegian ethnographer and world-renowned explorer and archaeologist Thor Heyerdahl claimed that the Scandinavian god Odin was actually based in part on a historical figure who had originated from the Caucasus and then migrated with a large number of his people to Scandinavia, and that Scandinavians are the descendants of the people who once lived in the region now known as Azerbaijan, near modern-day Turkey. Almost 12,000 years ago, Göbekli Tepe, the oldest known human settlement using megalithic stone architecture, located in southeast Anatolia, was used as a calendar sanctuary and site of ritual gatherings. In the center stood a massive stone and what I interpret as symbolically representing a tree of life. Around it are 12 stone poles with carvings of a zodiac of 12 animals that symbolize the solar year of a dozen months, of 30 days each, a total of 360. The same calendar division of 360 for the solar year was used by the ancient Egyptians and in Mesoamerica. On the left is an image of the Egyptian amphilos, a word which is used to describe a religious stone artifact, and as you can see, is divided into 36 sections. And on the right is an illustration of the outer rim of an Aztec calendar wheel, also divided into 36 sections, with 4 sections on each of the inner arms for a total of 52. Other examples of amphilos stones have been found at sacred sites such as Delphi in Greece, and one dated to 7,000 years ago from the Vinca culture housed at the Sofia Museum in Bulgaria. These sites were used for rituals on dates of astrological significance that culminated in divination, a term which means to be inspired by God, and was an attempt to gain insight into a question or situation, a method of seeking divine knowledge through trance-like, ecstatic states of consciousness, or through supernatural means that would seek knowledge of future events by means of prolonged tantric sexual ritual, sometimes before or after a sacrifice, while reciting certain mantras. Knowledge of these rituals have been retained through the ages and are still practiced by secret societies until today. This clip was aired on Turkish television in 1997, allegedly taken with a hidden camera inside of a Masonic lodge during a ritual only accessible to members of the 33rd degree. The footage appears to show a goat being sacrificed on a checkered floor, with its blood being consumed as prayers are being recited in the Hebrew language. While the footage itself is not particularly shocking, I've included it to show that while most modern Jews dismiss occult rituals as irrational folklore, the incantation, or spell as a spoken word, recited as part of a larger ritual in order to effect a magical result, is taken very seriously by some of the most prominent members of society since remote antiquity. Most cultures have some idea about words having supernatural constructive powers, but nowhere is this belief stronger than in Judaism, and the Hebrew or Phoenician language itself is not arbitrary sounds but specifically based on a mathematics that is considered literally sacred, implying that our words can, under certain conditions, have supernatural, constructive, and destructive power. The Babylonian Talmud preserves several examples of spells, and these types of incantations continue to expand in number and variety of purpose throughout the Middle Ages, especially based on astrological power, or what Renaissance adepts would dub natural magic, which deals with astrology, alchemy, and the natural forces of nature directly, as opposed to ceremonial magic that involves the alleged summoning of spirits. So while the Bible states that Jews are forbidden from being a quote, soothsayer or a sorcerer or a charmer or a medium or a wizard or a necromancer, end quote, it also appears from these texts that the Bible views magic as a real phenomenon and that the most revered figures in the Bible engage in magical arts. So how can we distinguish a prayer from a spell or superstition from a religious ritual? It seems that whether an unusual or supernatural event is considered a miracle and therefore praiseworthy, or magic and therefore deplorable, depends on who does it and for what purpose. My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. My published work is available on Amazon as well as through various other major book outlets. They make a great gift. If you'd like to support my work, you can do that through patreon.com. There should be a link in the description section for those who are interested. I appreciate it. Thank you. Please hit the like button and subscribe for future updates. As always, I look forward to reading your comments, so please leave me your thoughts below. Please have a wonderful week, and I hope to see you again soon.